Lord, we thank you for this day that has been, and for the new day about to begin now. We ask you to bless us as we seek to see ourselves as you see us. Help us to be truly open. Help us to know your patience, to know our own needs. We ask you this for ourselves and for each other, through Jesus Christ our Lord. So as we mentioned, the first day of the retreat, which we've come to the end of, is a sort of settling in and a painting in of the backdrop. And I think it's a very important time. Keep in mind that what we were seeking was precisely to experience God's personal love for us. And I think it's important perhaps to stress that it's good to stay with that as long as it's necessary. As I say, in a large group like this where we have to present things at a certain pace, we can't adapt to each one individually as we would do in a directed retreat. I think it's important that you find your own pace within this. So, for example, if you were very tired today or if you had a hard time getting into it, fine. That's part of the game at certain times in our life. But I would say don't rush ahead. Stay with it as long as necessary. And the test would be, as I mentioned last night, the grace that we seek. So I think the norm for moving on would be if I feel the grace of that experiential knowledge of God's personal love has been given, then it would be good to move on. I mentioned to you that I think we are sort of painting in the background during this first day, so that now we begin the new day. I also mentioned to you last night that I think it's very fruitful to make a repetition of the day sometime before you finish. And you could do that this evening if you wish, or you might have done it before Mass, I don't know. But what I would do there is just go back and reread the journal for the day, and make that the starting point of your prayer in that final hour, and then ask the Lord for the grace to see the unity of the whole experience. As I was mentioning at the Mass in connection with the Emmaus incident, I think probably the big problem in our lives is precisely that we don't see the meaning of what's happening. I myself see the examine of consciousness as very much connected with that. I think there's no doubt that the examine is a very essential part of any genuine holiness and any genuine growth. I think it's also true that probably it has sort of faded out of our consciousness recently. And I think the reason is because it was somewhat distorted, maybe in a somewhat Pharisaical way, in past years. So perhaps we had to, as it were, let go of the whole thing before we could come to a proper balance. But as in so many other areas of our post-Vatican II life, I think the time is coming where we should be able to come to that balance and recapture what is essential without recapturing all of the distortions. Now, in this area of the examen, I think probably one of the things that was a problem was seeing it too much in the context of law. Just as confession, I think, has been seen too juridically, so I think the examen also was. And I mentioned yesterday when someone asked me that for me probably the best source on this is that article of Father George Ashenbrenner on consciousness examen, which came out in the Review for Religious in 1972. I think it was January of 72. Which is a very beautiful thing. John English and others have also written about it in similar terms. But I think probably Ashenbrenner's was the earliest. And I'm biased anyway because he was a classmate of mine. He was a man who had a future perhaps as a professional baseball player. But instead he decided to become a novice master. And now he's working with Kara in Washington, I think. He's out of the novice master's job. But that's a very fine article. And the point he makes there precisely is that in the examine we review, as it were, how God has been speaking to me in the day. That's the first step after asking for light, to let the day flow before me and see where the Lord has been revealing himself to me in this day. And then to ask in the light of that, how have I responded? How sensitive have I been to the Lord speaking? Now notice that's different from the old practice we had, most of us, in that it focuses on the positive first. And secondly, it situates our sinfulness in the context not of law, but of God's love and of his word to us. I think if people make the examine that way, it will never become routinary or boring, because God's word to us is never the same in any 2 days. They're never exactly alike. And therefore my question of how I have responded to his word will not be the same in any 2 days either, because it's always a different word, a different part of the dialogue that is being spoken. Good. Now, that's what George says. What I wanted to do was say something a bit further, that I think the examine properly done is really an exercise in what you might call conscientization. I don't know if you use that term here, but I'm sure the idea is present, even if the term is not. For example, the Jesuit University in Manila, where I teach, where the seminary is located, the Ateneo, is a place where people generally are fairly wealthy by our local standards, because the tuition is quite high. Our seminarians are poor, but the average Atenean and the vast majority of them are pretty well-to-do. So one of the problems we have faced is that, we have a country with no middle class, or a very small middle class. That's one of the great difficulties. I don't think you can have a democracy without a middle class. See, we have about 10% of the people owning 80% of the wealth, and the other 90% of the people with the other 20%. So there's an enormous gulf. Everybody who comes to Manila is most shocked by the contrast between rich and poor, often side by side. In our culture, people who are prosperous show it all. It's a little different, I suppose, from Australia, and certainly in the States. That would be considered bad taste if everything you owned was on your back. But in the Philippines, you'll find people with bathtubs with gold handles and doors with gold handles and things that, even if you could afford them, would be considered rather gauche in the States. So the contrasts are very striking to almost everybody who comes there. Now, in that context, we had to face at the Ateneo, what should we be doing about this? And this is where that conscientization idea comes in. In our theology courses now, normally at some point the young people, men and women, because the university is now co-ed, they have to go out in some of their theology courses for exposure programs in the slums, in the rural areas where the indentured squatters work, so to speak. And then there's a kind of mix of exposure and theological reflection. Now, the purpose of that program, which I think is very good, the purpose of it is not to change the social situation now. And I always stress that, even with the seminarians, that the primary purpose of their apostolate during formation is not to change people's lives, because their primary job right now is to study and get the professional competence they need. And I think with our students too, the primary purpose, I think, of sending them out like that is not that they can do a great deal about it now, but to open their eyes so that later on, when they're running the banks and the businesses, they won't be able to walk down the street and see somebody in the gutter and not notice them. I think that's what I'd mean by conscientization. Now, if that makes sense to you, I think it's a good analogy for the examine. See, the purpose of the examine, I think, is precisely to open our eyes to what is happening in our lives. Much is happening, but we don't have the eyes to see it. And I think the examine is a great tool of sensitivity or conscientization. So that if I'm faithful to the examine, particularly in the early years, I think gradually I will have the eyes to see God working as he works. If I take the time, for example, in the evening to review the day and to try to see then where he has been working and I haven't seen it, perhaps tomorrow I will see it when it's happening. That, I think, is the real purpose of the examine. And in an extended way, it's the real purpose of this first week, which we're beginning now, this evening, the first week of the exercises. In fact, I think in our religious life, you have a very nice pattern of sort of expanding circles. If you think of it, the daily examine, the monthly recollection, and the annual retreat. I think all of them fit one pattern. In other words, I gradually seek to see the unity of my whole life, day by day, month by month, year by year, letting the whole thing flow together. So I think one dimension of the retreat is a kind of expanded realization of what we're doing daily in the examine and monthly in the recollection. I always tell the seminarians that in the monthly recollection, whatever topic they get or whoever gives the recollection, basically the purpose of the recollection is the same. The topics give it a little variety, but the basic purpose of it every month is to see the whole month with the eyes of God, just as the purpose of the examine is to see the day with the eyes of God. And we could say one purpose of the retreat is to see the year with the eyes of God. So with that as background, let's turn now to the first week. I'd like to give you a little explanation of the dynamics of Ignatius. I like to use a little example. I think I begin with this. Some years ago, about 4 years ago, I think it was, when I went away to write Darkness in the Marketplace, which seems like ancient history now, but I went home to write that, and we have a very wonderful man at San Jose Seminary, Mang Marciano. Mang is kind of reverential, sir, I suppose, if we still use that. And Mang Marciano cannot read and write. In fact, one mystery for me at San Jose is that when the secretary is out, they put him on the telephone. And I've always found that very mysterious, because unless you're there, messages are lost forever, because he can't read or write. And I'm sure the others must know that, but nobody seems to register on the fact that this might make it hard to be a secretary. So he's been there since before I joined the Jesuits. I joined the Jesuits in 49. I think Marciano's been there since 48. His wife died some years ago, and I was blessed to be there and say the funeral mass. He's married again, a widow, with about 5 children of her own, and he has about 8. And really great, wonderful person, and a very good friend of mine. When I went away in 1980, I said to Marce, could you water my plants? Now, that requires some background. I think I may have mentioned this in Shepperton, but some years ago I decided I had to have something living in my room besides me. And since I couldn't have a wife, the plants seemed like the best alternative. So I have a few things growing there, some of them rather seedy looking. Their main claim to fame is that they've survived so long. But I said to Marce, well, I'll be away for about 4 months, so would you water those while I'm away? And he said, sure. So I went away peacefully, in my naivete. And when I came back about 4 months later and went into my room, all the plants were dead, and they were all soaking wet. They all were very thoroughly watered. I think he must have realized about 2 weeks before I returned that he hadn't watered them. So he tried to make up for lost time during those last 2 weeks, with the result that I had a lot of wet, dead plants. four or five of them anyway, which is about all the room will hold. So what do you do at that point? This is where I see a good metaphor for the first week. Well, you could sit down and cry, which might help for a while, but sooner or later you have to move. Now, if I want the only reasonable thing it seems to me to do, there's no sense getting angry at him because you just lose a friend and it wouldn't accomplish anything. But the only thing it seemed to me that I could do was empty out the pots and start over. Now, there's the analogy. See, you can't put new life in unless you empty out the, what we call the basura, the garbage, the debris, which is what I did. Now, if that analogy makes sense to you, I think it's a good analogy for the first and second weeks of the exercises. I teach a course in giving retreats. The first week focuses, traditionally it's been said, on sin, although I'll recast that in a moment. The second week focuses on Christ. My students in the course on giving retreats always like to set the first week aside, especially today. This is the age of the Paschal mystery. So the sooner we can get into it, the better. So they're very impatient with this first week sin business. We've abolished sin anyway, so they don't care much for it. I always tell them that's very dangerous. If you, for example, have a weekend retreat for kids or young people or fringe Christians, sure, it's great to give them the Paschal mystery, but the trouble is it won't last until Tuesday. If you finish the retreat on Sunday, it'll be gone by Tuesday. Why? Well, this is where the pot metaphor comes in. You can't be filled with new life unless there's a space. You can't be filled with Christ unless you've emptied out yourself. And that's the danger in our kind of enthusiastic movement, what Ronnie Knox has called enthusiastic movements. His great book is called Enthusiasm, the one he thought was the most important of his life. And prophetically, what he's talking about there, even though he wrote in the 40s, are charismatic movements, which go back to the very beginning of the church. And he traces their whole history there in that very interesting book. Now, I read something recently saying he was against them. I don't think he was against the charismatic movements, but I think he was cautious in a way that, in my judgment, any charismatic should be cautious. See, it's Jesus' parable about the seed that falls on rocky ground. What happens? It grows up very fast where the ground is shallow, because all of the nourishment goes into the stalk and the flowers. There's no room for roots. Well-rooted plants grow much more slowly, and you have to wait a lot longer for the payoff, because much of the early nourishment goes below the ground. So Corsilio conversion, at least in the Philippines, this has almost become synonymous with dramatic conversions that don't last long. The fault is not with the Corsilio, because they have always stressed that the most important day is the fourth day, which is the rest of your life. But unfortunately, the principles of the founders and the principles of some of the charismatic leaders haven't always been the practice of their followers. So you get very dramatic conversions which don't last. Why? Well, it's like pouring water on a stone. The stone is quite wet for a while, but all the water flows off. None of it is able to be absorbed because there's no space for it. So I think that's a very good image for the first and second week in the retreat. The purpose of the first week is to hollow out a space for God so that in the second week we can be filled with Him. Or if you like to shift the metaphor, one that I like very much, the purpose of the first week is to be naked before the Lord in order that in the second week I can be clothed with Christ. Now the problem is that all of us wear masks, and I include myself there preeminently. But I wouldn't say preeminently, because my mother says I'm too frank, which I take as a good thing. She'd like it if I was a little more deceptive, I think, at times, but I guess the older I get, the more I think, well, it's stupid to worry about what people think, because I'm not going to face them on Judgment Day. I only wish I'd discovered that 30 years ago. I could have been a lot happier. But I think still in all, we do wear masks. And I think most of us, maybe all of us, wear masks even when we look in the mirror. That is, we even kid ourselves about who we really are. Those of you who were there yesterday, I was talking about how difficult it is to name our own feelings. You know, it's amazing how we can fool ourselves. I'm thrifty, you're tight with money, and she's stingy. Yeah, it all depends on who we're talking about, how we describe the same thing, doesn't it? The very same actions get a different coloring if I'm doing it or if you're doing it or if somebody who's absent is doing it. So we do wear masks, I think, even when we look in the mirror. So I think the grace of the first week is not really sorrow for sin. That's one possible effect, felt effect. But I think the grace of the first week is, as I have it on the page there, to see myself as God sees me. The reason I got thinking about this is that I found in my own life in retreats and also in directing retreats of others that as the years went by, it was very difficult to recapture that sort of sorrow. You may have noticed that yourself. And I wondered about that. I suppose if I were only by myself, I would have thought there was something wrong with me. But since I found it in so many people I was directing also, I began to realize it must be something more than just me. And it forced me to think. See, I believe the reason we can't recapture that sorrow, and you may be happy to hear me say that we shouldn't even try to sort of have a real orgy of grief again for my sins, the reason is because we've settled that already, most of us. And if our sinfulness is buried in Christ, if for God as is true, our past sins are as if they never existed, then it's rather strange if we can keep regurgitating that sorrow. It doesn't make any sense theologically as well as psychologically. But I think if you think of it this way, the real goal of Ignatius, I think, and our real goal, is to know myself. And, as I say, to be naked before the Lord. To get rid of those masks, those pretenses, those illusions by which most of us live most of the time. For a beginner, I mentioned to you that I believe that St. Ignatius was writing for beginners here. For a beginner, that would reflect itself as sorrow. Somebody like Xavier, who felt quite complacent. He was a good man by the standards of the University of Paris. You know, he wasn't sleeping around, he wasn't robbing anybody, he wasn't cheating in his courses. And I'm sure he felt quite self-satisfied. Until he made the exercises and realized that he'd been making the wrong comparison. He shouldn't be comparing himself to his fellow students. He should be comparing himself to God and to the grace of God to him. Or, to shift my example a moment, St. Teresa of Avila says in her writings a few times that she considered herself the greatest of sinners. Now, that used to drive me crazy when I read that, because Teresa's a very sane person normally, talkative but sane. And I couldn't believe that she could mean that. I used to find myself saying, oh, come off it, you know. In fact, I often say to people today, and I would say to you, don't think of yourself as the greatest of sinners, because that's vanity. See, we all have to be greatest at something. Why not just be an ordinary sinner? Why do you have to be outstanding? You know, when people tell me that, Father, I am the greatest of sinners, you know, I'm tempted to say congratulations. You know, you've hit the top. No, just be an ordinary garden variety sinner. be satisfied with mediocrity. But Teresa says that, and although, as I say, it's not exactly my style of talking, I think it puzzled me, because she's usually not somebody who talks in those pleiosities. And I think now that probably she really meant it, and I think I understand what she meant. It does make sense. See, I think what she was saying was that, considering how good God had been to her, she couldn't have imagined anybody else responding so little. Anybody who had been blessed as she was blessed, she couldn't imagine them responding as little as she had. And that makes very good sense. I think that maybe is what Xavier had to discover. Sure, that my smugness in itself is sin, is a forgetfulness of God, taking credit for what is pure gift. So, as I say, I think for a beginner, in some sense, sorrow would be the inevitable fruit. Remember, it's the feelings we discern. I think sorrow would be the inevitable fruit of a discovery of how God sees me. That could happen in your life this week, but my point is, it's not the only fruit that self-knowledge might have. You might find it deadly dry. Suppose it was as dry as the desert from now until tomorrow night, and you came to me in direction and told me that. Oh, you know what I would say to you? I'd say, well, have you gotten the message? Can you see how that's the answer to the grace you were seeking? And if you can't, I might give you a few clues, but I'd suggest you reflect on it more deeply. Maybe the Lord's showing you what you are without Him. He sees you, perhaps, as absolutely barren without Him. That experience of total dryness might very well be the answer to the grace to see myself as God sees me. Sometimes people might experience great gratitude that I'm still alive. Sometimes they might experience a great sense of their littleness and God's immensity. That could easily happen today, because we're living in an age where we're all demanding our rights. Everybody, I'm number one, look out for number one. Well, I think anybody with that attitude who met God might get quite a shock. You know, the realization that here I've been pushing number one, and if the Lord stops thinking of me for, you know, if He stopped thinking of you for 1 second, you wouldn't die. There'd just be an empty space on that chair. We would cease to exist if He stopped thinking of us for a moment. That's how radically we depend on Him. When you look at taking care of number one in the light of that, it looks rather stupid. You know, where we're protecting our own interests and staking out our own claim. You're like a flea on an elephant, trying to assert your identity and your superiority. The elephant turns over and you're finished. I think seeing myself as God sees me could lead to a lot of feelings. And therefore, I wouldn't focus only on the sorrow. That's one possibility. But it could hit us in many ways. Good. Does that make sense? Crazy, but sense? Good.